I'm going to turn it over to the great David K. Johnston.
Thank you, pal. Hello. Thank you for coming here tonight. You know, I hope students came for more than free food, but I understand it was otherwise. I want to start off by telling you about why we gave the book the title we did. It wasn't my title. It was the head of Simon & Schuster who chose. It's Even Worse Than You Think. And the reason is, even if you think things are terrible, and not everybody does, there are a lot of people who think this is, as Orrin Hatch suggested, potentially the greatest president ever. You don't know what's in my book because it's what hasn't been reported in the news. It's about what is going on inside our government. And one of the principles we follow at DC Report is we always refer to our Constitution and our government, not the alienating phrase news organizations use, the government, as if it is a power unto itself. It's our government, we own it, we need to act like owners. And Donald Trump, like Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and everybody back to George Washington, is our employee. We're the bosses. And I think a lot of Americans have forgotten that. They have come up and accepted this notion that they have no power and no influence and they can't do anything. And it's not true. The most important election in the history of this country since the Civil War will occur this fall. And we will find out something about whether our democracy is on the wane and we are headed down a path where your liberties will be gone because somebody who doesn't have Donald's deficits but has all of his charisma, has all of his authoritarian instincts, and is a competent manager will become president of the United States if we don't change the direction of the country. And whatever happens, it's what we chose. Because the entire idea of this country is that we choose our destiny. We created this country to ennoble the human spirit and see what human beings could achieve. And we've certainly had a rocky history. We started out with a great and immoral compromise that allowed people to own other people. And if that war were fought again today that ended it, it would be the equivalent of more than 6 million Americans, about 400,000 of them African Americans, dying over that cause. In the 1890s, when child labor laws were proposed, the Jerry Falwells and other preachers of the God wants you to send me money so I can be rich variety were going around saying it is God's plan that these children work in the factories and those proposing the child labor laws are the agents of the devil. We don't live in a time different than those. We don't live in a time different than when women conducted a 7-decade-long struggle to get men to grant them the right to vote. But we are at an inflection point in our country about where we're going. We have in the White House a man who has no regard for anyone but himself. The first chapter of my book goes through previous presidents. And the one closest to Donald is Chester Arthur, the 21st president of the United States, who became president only because the man who was president got sick and died a month into office. Now, Chester Arthur was an unbelievably corrupt New York City politician. And he told his cronies to come see him at the White House. And they were all rubbing their hands and thinking how rich they were going to get. And he said, "Gentlemen, I'm now the president of the United States. Leave this building and never darken the door of the White House again." And from him, we got the Pendleton Civil Service Act that created the professional government we have that has helped make all of us wealthier, safer, and healthier. And Donald Trump has already signaled his intention that he wants to replace that with a patronage government in which everyone must pledge loyalty to Donald Trump. Some of you may have missed it, but during the campaign, on the campaign trail, he would ask the whole audience to pledge loyalty to him. Not to the Constitution, but to him personally. And unfortunately, during the campaign, nobody asked a question that I thought needed to be asked. I wrote 3 questions for Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, tried to get me fired when I worked at the New York Times over the only two stories I ever wrote that had the words Hillary Clinton in them, and then changed her policies after the stories ran. And three for Donald. Hers were really tough questions. Donald's key question was this. Donald, you've been talking about being president of the United States since 1985. That's more than 30 years. Presumably, you have read and perhaps even studied the job description. Would you please tell us with specificity where the job description is and what the duties, powers, and limits of the presidency are? I imagined how Donald would have answered this. Well, you know, it's like, it's so awesome, the power of the presidency. It's like really important. That's why they put it in the Constitution. It's like, it's really crucial. Well, where in the Constitution? Well, it's in the Constitution. Which article of the Constitution, sir? I'll make it easy for you. One, two, or three? He doesn't know. He does not know. Has no idea. He is the most manifestly unfit person ever to serve in that office. And we've had some really not very fit people. Prior to January 20th of last year, Donald Trump had performed exactly 0 days of public service. Zero. Now, in my previous book, which is a worldwide bestseller in 11 languages, The Making of Donald Trump, I go through entirely from the public record Donald's lifelong career as a criminal. I discuss at length his deep entanglement with a major international cocaine trafficker, an entanglement that could and should have cost him his casino license at the time, an entanglement that makes no sense whatsoever for him to be involved with a twice-convicted mob associate felon who confesses to being a major international drug trafficker and whose case is handled in the most unusual way. He's indicted in Cincinnati, Ohio, for bringing drugs from Colombia to Florida to Ohio. And his case is then moved to a state where no crime is alleged to have occurred, New Jersey, and to the courtroom of relatively newly appointed federal judge Marianne Trump Berry. Now, she recused herself from the case, as the law requires, after a few weeks, and the case was assigned to the person closest to her on the bench. But what's significant about that is why she had to recuse herself. Sometimes Joe Exelbaum, the drug trafficker, would pilot the Ivana, Donald Trump's personal helicopter. Sometimes this federal judge flew in that helicopter with the drug trafficker at the controls. Her husband flew back and forth to Atlantic City every week, sometimes several times a week, as a lawyer for the Trump casinos, riding in Joe Exelbaum's helicopters, which, by the way, were mostly financed with New Jersey tax credits. Helicopter company goes broke 3 times. Donald sticks with this guy and then writes a letter on Trump Organization stationery about how Joe Exelbaum is a stand-up guy. He's a, quote, credit to the community and shouldn't go to prison. Well, it worked. Oh, well, first of all, by the way, when the New Jersey casino authorities ask him about this letter, which should have cost him his casino license, Donald says, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't write any such letter. They get the letter, they come back, they show him the letter, and according to the official report, they said, Donald said, oh, that's my signature, I don't remember. Man with the world's greatest memory. There's no indication they asked the next obvious question. Why would you write a letter like this for a major international drug trafficker? At the sentencing of this guy, he ended up serving 18 months. To get out early, he had to show he had a job and a place to live. And he said, I'm going back to work for Donald as his helicopter consultant. And he moved into a and he said, I can't pay the $30,000 in federal fines. He paid $600 of it in three $200 checks, but never paid another penny. Many criminals never pay their fines. But he moved into, despite having no money, a multimillion-dollar apartment in Trump Tower. Absolutely. So I was very concerned the day Donald Trump announced in 2015 that he just might become president. I didn't think it was likely, but I certainly thought it's possible. And I looked at the field of Republicans who were running and thought he certainly could get the nomination. You may recall a lot of the people back then, there were 17 at the peak, were referred to as the clown car. And I would apply that description to all of them with the exception of John Kasich, who is a competent administrator and has demonstrated that and was a very informed member of Congress. You may not like a lot of his policies, I certainly don't, but he's competent. The only one who was. Well, when Donald won the Electoral College after losing the popular vote, I was very surprised that there was no coverage at all about what is the purpose of the Electoral College. The Electoral College was put in place for two reasons. One was to give smaller states something of a voice, but it was also put there, and the framers of our Constitution wrote about this, so that if the mob rule, because they were all worried about democracy and whether the passions of the people could be inflamed, if a crazy person or a zealot or someone unfit for office somehow won the popular election, the purpose of the Electoral College was to block that person. Unfortunately, after 200 years, it's like not going to the gym, as Donald never does, you atrophy. The question in front of us now is, has our entire Constitution atrophied, or can we bring it back? So let me tell you a few of the things that Donald has done that are contrary to his promises. You know, Donald talks about how he's there for the workers. He's there for you, you know. And one of the smartest things he always does is, I love you. I love you. We love our police, don't we? We all love our police. I love you. Very smart move by him. So the U.S. government has an office to help small manufacturers who want to export goods. Now, if you're General Electric, you have executives overseas, you have fleets of private jets, you've got offices all around the world. But if you're, you know, Joe's company in Newark, Delaware, and you do $400,000 a year in Britain and $250,000 a year in Venezuela, you can't afford that kind of business. So the U.S. government finances an office to help these kinds of businesses. Now, the way I read the official documents, for every dollar that we spend on this, it is a subsidy program to help these small businesses. We sell $831 worth of goods. There's a congressional report that puts it in the mid-700s. Donald's budget puts it below $100. But why in the world would you want to cut a program that creates American jobs selling exports overseas if you're really concerned about trade deals and America getting the bad deal? First budget, zero it out. I love the veterans. Nobody loves the veterans more than Donald Trump, right? You all know that. Nobody loves them more than I do. We love our veterans, and we're going to take care of our veterans. So what did they propose in their first budget a year ago? That many disabled veterans, my father probably would have fallen to this category. He was a disabled veteran from World War II who eventually became 100% disabled. When they reach retirement age, will have their annual benefit cut from $35,000 a year to $13,000 a year, plunging them into poverty. Now, Congress is never going to let that happen, but that's not the point. Donald Trump doesn't love the veterans. As one of the senators calls him, cadet bone spurs draft dodger, doesn't care at all about the veterans. He just wants to make you think he cares about the veterans. They also had another proposal, by the way. They wanted all veterans' checks rounded down. So if your check was $1,112.99, you would get $1,129, no 99 cents. It's not a lot of money. For the whole country, it's in the book, I calculated it, $6 or $12 million a year. But the symbolism is quite clear. If Donald cares about national security, why is it that we don't have an ambassador in Saudi Arabia, or Egypt, or Jordan, or Libya? There's no ambassador there. Why? If Donald cares about trade deals, why is there no ambassador in Australia? Now, I want you to raise your hand. How many people here, and keep your hand up if you know this, have heard of the RCEP? Almost nobody. I don't think anybody raised their hand at all? Nobody in the whole room. Okay. The RCEP is one of the most important issues in this country and the world, affecting your income and the future income of your children, or if you're my age, grandchildren, and perhaps in great-grandchildren. And that is, Donald Trump came into office and killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a proposed Pacific trading zone of 12 countries plus the U.S. Now, I was one of the most prominent critics of the TPP, but my criticism was that it took away some rights that individuals and small businesses have, and it benefited monopolies too much. Those are solvable problems. You fix the thing, which is, by the way, the agreement's, if I recall correctly, 30,000 pages. It's enormous. The chapter that got out first was chapter QQ, which gives you an idea of how long this thing was. Donald comes into office and he just kills it. He doesn't do anything to replace it. He creates a vacuum. Into that vacuum steps President Xi of China. And he proposes the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. 15 Pacific Rim countries, including China but not the US, plus India. So it's a much bigger trading zone than our deal. And Chinese emissaries have been going to these countries and saying, listen, you want to have a prosperous future. China is the country of the future. Look at America. America's in decline. Look who's in their White House. Really, you want to make, they don't even want to make a deal with you. We want to make a deal with you. We want to get rich together in partnership. When I was in Australia last fall, part of this trip I did where I went 51,000 miles in 5 weeks in airplanes, everybody I spoke to, everybody, I mean from people who were important up here to the chambermaid at my hotel, were all saying, you know, Australia, which is America's most loyal ally, an absolute lapdog to American policy since at least World War II, Australia is starting to have to pivot toward China and away from America because we've left this vacancy. At the Environmental Protection Agency and many other agencies, Team Trump, not Donald personally because he's lazy, he spends about 4.5 hours a day or 5 hours a day being president, and that includes lunch. And remember, during the campaign, he said that if elected, he was not going to actually do the duty of being president. He would have somebody else do it, and he'd do the things he wanted to do, like presumably play golf. Donald's team has put into our government what I call in the book political termites. People you don't see, people in many cases whose names you don't hear, they're not in the public record, except very technically. And their job is to eat away at the structure of our government. We have, for example, since Richard Nixon was president, exhaustive point source pollution records. Well, a lot of those records have disappeared from the internet. We don't know if they've been destroyed or compromised. They've stopped posting the names of workers killed on the job. That stopped last August. They won't even give statistical information. Well, how many workers were electrocuted? How many people have been crushed in machinery? How many fell to their deaths? You can't have that. You're not allowed to have that anymore under this administration. They are systematically destroying the capacity of the government of the United States to carry out the duties that Donald Trump took an oath of office to faithfully execute. So I want to take questions from you, but I really seriously hope that a lot of you will read my book. The overwhelming reaction of people who have read it here, in Europe, in Germany, where it's a bestseller also on the German list. I was number 2 on the New York Times list and number 3 on the Wall Street Journal list. The overwhelming reaction has been, I had no idea. I didn't know any of this stuff. And in most cases, you won't, because it either was not in the news at all, because we don't do a very good job of covering government, or it was just mentioned in passing or glancing. You may have some knowledge of it. But that you don't know about the RCEP alone should say to you, it's even worse than you think. So, thank you.
So, who has the first question?
Thank you, this was really informative. These things that you've said all strike me as important facts about Donald Trump. Yet, none of them appear on CNN or MSNBC. These stations have driven me crazy going on for days on end about...
So why isn't it there? Is that
about,
the question?
Wait, Rob Porter or paying the porn star. Why are they descended so low and not putting out these really important facts?
I got it. So the question for those of you in the back is, why is CNN and MSNBC and Fox, you know, they'll talk about Stormy Daniels being paid off and Rob Porter, you know, the alleged wife beater day after day, and not the stuff I've been talking about. Well, first of all, it's TV, you know, and the TV is entirely a ratings game. And, hey, you know, read about the president and the porn star or listen to the thing is a better headline than termites are eating away at the records in the Labor Department. Secondly, the fastest disappearing white-collar job in America in this century is journalist. There are 40% fewer journalists today, or to look at it the other way, there were 67% more journalists in this country 17 years ago. Yeah. And also, covering government, the operations of government, but I think that many, many reporters, they don't have any in-depth knowledge of how government works and the way it works and why it matters. It's a skill set, and it's a skill set that's been largely lost. Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to ask two questions. One of them is the Trump base and the R's.
Who are they?
Well, not who they are. I'm very concerned about the fact that all the transgressions that happen with this person, nobody acknowledges it.
Okay.
From the R's or the base. And the second question I have is, how is Trump loading up the judiciary right now?
So the first question is about Donald Trump and why his base is with him. People who say, I'm religious, but the Stormy Daniels thing doesn't bother them. And
right.
I assure you, she's far from the only person paid hush money like this. And the answer to that, I would argue, is that a lot of people who assert that they hold deeply biblical values, because I've interviewed lots and lots of these people going back to when I was a teenager, they don't know what's in their Bible. They have no idea what's in their Bible. There's a great scene in, I think it's the second episode of The West Wing, but maybe it's the first one, where a group of evangelical political influencers are in The West Wing, and someone says, gets one of the commandments wrong, and the pastor says, well, then what is that commandment? The door flings open, and Jed Bartlett walks in and says, I am Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods in front of me. But a lot of these people, they're fake Christians, okay? And the answer that you will get from people like Franklin Graham about Donald Trump, he said it on TV the other day. Well, he's changed. Of course, a fundamental principle of Christianity is that you repent and you seek forgiveness. In my previous book, The Making of Donald Trump, I quote Donald, who has said in one of his books, Think Big, in videotape talks, and in the numerous other forums over many years, that anyone who turns the other cheek is a fool, an idiot, or a schmuck. And he says that his personal life philosophy is revenge, and if there's anything explicitly rejected in the New Testament, it's revenge. As to the judiciary, you know, Mitch McConnell invented two new clauses in the Constitution during the Barack Obama administration. The more better known one is that, you know, no president in the last year of his term may appoint a Supreme Court nominee. I searched and searched in my Constitution. It's only 7,000 words long. I can't find it. And the other unspoken one was, no black president's going to have any judges appointed if I can avoid it. And this was just plain racism. You know, I mean, just flat out racism. There was a tremendous amount of racism against Barack Obama, who played defensive chess. Played it very well. I don't think history's going to regard him as a great president, but he also was dealt a terrible set of cards. So who's next?
You have a lot of educators and students in the audience. Could you say a few words about what we ought to be thinking about doing right now?
Well, first of all, you ought to be really disturbed that Donald is the anti-education president. I have a chapter that points out that Trump has taken the side of the bankers against student loans. Called Bankers Against Brains, or Above Brains. We also ought to be asking the question, why is college a business that requires you to borrow money? It's an investment in the future of the country. The most valuable asset we have in the United States, it's not land, it's not water, it's not uranium or gold or oil. It's the unformed thinking patterns and rigor of young people's brains. And that should be our primary investment. There's very good research now that shows that every dollar we spend on young people from conception to 180 days after birth pays a lifetime compound annual rate of return of 7%. And I have a little piece of financial advice for the young people here. If you can find a real investment, not a phony one, that will pay you a compound 7% real rate of return over your lifetime, put everything you have into it. When you're my age, you'll be really well off. So, in education, it should be, why aren't we putting more money into education? Why are we proposing cutting spending on basic science? Half the economic growth in this country since 1945 comes from public investments in basic science. These little computers in your pocket, brought to you by the American taxpayer before World War II, with investments in physics, chemistry, material science, mathematics, and several other fields, all financed with your tax dollars. Along come companies like Qualcomm and Intel and Apple, who apply this knowledge to create products that create jobs and wealth. But the beginning of it is your tax dollars. Trump, there's a chapter about how he wants to, among other things, build a bunch of new warships there's no need for, and he wants to replace the new electromechanical catapult systems on the newest aircraft carrier, the Ford, which can throw up in the air planes much, much heavier than what we now launch from aircraft carriers. He wants to replace them with steam because, as he said, digital, you know, it's so complicated. You have to be Einstein to understand it. We're going to go back to steam. You hear me? Goddamn steam. We're going back to steam. Just like he wants to go back to beautiful, clean coal, beautiful coal.
Okay, first of all, let me make a statement, okay? I'm a Christian, and I truly believe I embrace all walks of life. I believe that there are many Christians, including a lot of my family members, who choose to be quiet. I know some of them, just bear with me.
Yeah.
But when in the Bible, when Jesus was accused, he kept his mouth shut. He didn't say anything against his accusers. I think a lot of them stand on that. I'm not speaking for everybody, but I think a lot of them stand on that. My question to you is, you brought this up in your talk, do you believe that we have a leg to stand on, that our Constitution is not broken, that we can deal with that and regroup and move on?
Well, that you've asked the question goes right to the heart of, you know, what's about to happen in this country. And, you know, Max Boot, people here know who Max Boot is? Max Boot was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's a very prominent and very principled Republican conservative. By the way, I'm a registered Republican. And Max Boot resigned the Republican Party publicly and said last week on, I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell, it's the duty of every Republican to vote against every Republican running for Congress because the Republicans have totally lost their way. They've lost their moral footing. They are not doing their duty as a check and a balance on the president, and they're going to destroy the country. And that's pretty strong, but yeah, I mean, I think we're going to find out. You know, remember, 100 million people in round numbers did not vote in the 2016 election. Gerrymandering generally involves districts that are 53, 54, maybe 55% the party that did the gerrymandering. You can overcome a 55%, 45% by just turning out the vote. It's not easy. And the question is, are people going to do the work, or are they going to continue to outsource our government to other people? By the way, in line with that, Donald Trump ran for president on an economic platform that I wrote. It's in my best-selling books, Perfectly Legal on Taxes, Free Lunch on Subsidies, and The Fine Print on Restraint of Trade. Donald didn't read the books, but I know he watched me on TV. And Drain the Swamp, and Washington's Working Against You, and They're Picking Your Pocket, and on. That's all. Those are all the points in my books that are all from documented data. So in some ways, I'm responsible.
All right, so you've mentioned a lot of things that are going on in the Trump administration, specifically in reference to decisions like the termites. In your opinion, is Trump the one orchestrating this? Is he an unwitting pawn, or is he somewhere in the middle?
Well, Donald's lazy, always been lazy. During the campaign, I couldn't believe it when he would say, Hillary's lazy, and you saw her every single day, dawn to dusk, until she collapsed literally at one point because she was sick and didn't stop working. And Donald would disappear for 2, 3, 4 days at a time into Trump Tower. Nobody just pointed out that fact. He had no appearances. Donald brought with him a team of people, and they're the ones who are doing this. Steve Bannon, his strategic advisor, said, he's a Leninist. A Leninist means you want to destroy the existing order, right? You want all the white Russians either murdered or sent to out of the country. And he said the purpose of the Trump administration is the deconstruction of the administrative state, which is highfalutin language for we hate the government and we're going to destroy it. And that's what they're doing. They're destroying its capacity to do its work. So it's the people around him who are doing this. Donald certainly has clear instincts. So over here.
David, what can we do to ensure in 2020 Donald is not our president?
Okay, so what do we do in 2020 to ensure? Well, the first thing to do is the 2018 elections, and that is get a change to Congress, because there will be investigations and hearings. And Watergate, on the day that Richard Nixon resigned, I spent the night he resigned and the next day with Pop Cherm, who was Jerry Ford's high school civics teacher, who taught him about integrity in government. 29% of Americans still supported Nixon, even though every single member of the Senate and Congress had turned against him, all 535. Getting a new Congress will result in public hearings. I don't think most Americans have a clue to how really bad this is, how disloyal Donald Trump is. Foreign governments were the ones that alerted us to what's going on with the Russians. And, you know, Steve Bannon said, you know, you're going to find out Donald Trump is disloyal and money laundering's at the bottom of it. People need to be registered to vote. You need to make sure if you're in a state where they've been removing people from the rolls, whether you've been removed. And a lot of this has been done in an unbelievable way. You know, everybody named John Smith was effectively removed in one state because there was one felon somewhere named John Smith. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little, but it's not much off. Get people to vote and then plan in advance to be in a district where something may change and be there election day and drive people to the polls. What matters is voting. That's what really matters. And by the way, don't discount the possibility that Donald Trump will get reelected in 2020. Be a big mistake to do that.
You mentioned money laundering. I'd like you to say a little bit more about that. And do you think that may be in Mueller's whole card?
So some more about money laundering and what that is. Donald Trump has been doing deals with Russians since at least 1983 that make no economic sense. The most famous one is this purchase and resale of a mansion about 2 miles from Mar-a-Lago. It's since been knocked over. It was built by some people who have even less taste than Donald. I mean, really, if you see it on TV, the pictures of the inside, it was just unbelievably tacky. Donald buys it for $40 million. He sells it to Dmitry Ribolovlov, who is one of the oligarchs. And the oligarchs from Russia are the biggest criminal organization in the history of the world. The oligarchs have the money because it was stolen from the people of Russia when the Soviet state, owned everything. And these criminals have tried to bring down the banking systems of the Netherlands and Britain and the pension systems there. That's what the Icelandic bank scandal was about, because the Icelandic banks were under one of the oligarchs. They have, some of them are getting subsidies from taxpayer subsidies here in America. And Donald sold this property in 2008 for $100 million. that he bought for 40 at a time when he publicly said the real estate market is dead, and he filed a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank saying I don't have to repay the $40 million loan I have from you because it's an act of God that destroyed the real estate market. No one will sell any properties. The cover story when this comes out is Dmitry Ryabalovlev was hiding money from his estranged wife he was divorcing. Now, if God forbid, you decide you're going to leave your wife, you're not going to go pay me 2.5 times or 3 times what my house is worth to hide the money. You might as well just get out a Zippo lighter and burn it. You're going to buy things at a discount. It was such a stupid, obvious lie, but it got repeated by reporters who don't understand economics because they don't own any property. They don't think about that. Trump has been, in the earlier book, I show how Trump did various deals where he swindled people out of money. The bank he is most involved with is Deutsche Bank, which has paid over $620 million in fines for laundering Russian money. And our Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, used to be the vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus. The chief executive of the Bank of Cyprus is the disgraced former head of the money laundering Deutsche Bank. And who is the other vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus? Cyprus is a big center for Russians who have left the country and live in this island near Turkey. The other vice chairman of the bank was Vladimir Putin's appointee. All roads lead to the Kremlin and money from the Kremlin. And if you're Vladimir Putin, who thinks democracy is a joke, and he's very upfront about that. This is a silly notion. People can't govern themselves. You have to have somebody like me to run things. You look at the world and you're trying to undermine democracies. You don't want to go to war. It's a very expensive way to do things. It's better to use cyber weapons and political means to undermine these governments. You get pitched 1,000 ideas by your staff, or you assign people on your staff to do things. You decide to fund 100 of opportunities to get influence somewhere. 95 of them, this is just like venture capitalism in Silicon Valley, 95 of them are a waste of money. 4 of them pay off enough to justify the 95 that failed. And then you get Amazon, Google, Donald Trump. And that's what Vladimir Putin got. Because he didn't want Hillary Clinton. She would make him feel severe pain if he didn't get out of Crimea. She wasn't going to take us to war over it, but she was going to make him hurt. She was very clear about that.
So that was a very nice transition to my question, which is I've been hearing the phrase computational propaganda, which is basically the Russians are using divisions that already exist and exacerbating them. What is your opinion about how we can combat that?
Okay, so what do we do about what's been called computational propaganda? Essentially manipulating social media, marketing devices to trick people and to sow discord. Because what Putin wants to do is have us not believe our election systems are reliable, believe the FBI is a criminal organization, as Donald wants us to believe. Well, one of the things about human beings is we make advances, and this is one of the big advances in the world. We have moved now into a world where the most important warfare may well take place with digits. It's a heck of a lot cheaper than doing it with guns and tanks. And we're way behind everybody else in this in the world. The Russians have incredibly great computer experts. As, you know, I don't know if the story's ever been proven, but it's widely believed because of some little bits of code that Oracle, which started out as a CIA contract to allow the CIA to keep track of all the massive data that they had, because they just couldn't do it the old-fashioned way, you know, paper cards and files, was computer software stolen from the Russians. And what do we do about it? Well, a lot of things. First of all, Robert J. O'Hara, the Washington Post, about 6 years ago, wrote a series about why we spend all this money on malware protection and firewalls. And it turns out that when the internet was new, a government-financed project, some of the experts said we need to design certain things into it so we always know who's doing what, and therefore you can't damage the internet. And of course, then came the people who said, it's too much money. We can't afford it. It would have been something like a fraction of a penny on every dollar we now spend for our failed systems about this. And, you know, they're going to be real problems. I mean, there's going to come a day when you're going to go to the teller, the automated teller, and you won't be able to get any money. It'll get fixed, but, you know, keep some cash around because it's going to happen. There's going to come a day when the electric grid may go down. Why we're building a national electric grid is to me, and I write a lot about electricity regulation. I taught regulation at Syracuse Law. Why would you do that? You want to have separate, discrete grids that are not subject to big takedowns. And this is a real problem, and we're not addressing it. And this administration in particular is not addressing it as Congress has been told.
Go ahead.
The standard account of Hillary's loss is that she didn't really campaign or win over the white workers.
Right.
They were formerly Democrat, and they shifted to...
Why did Hillary lose? Is that the question?
Do you buy that argument?
Well, yes and no. First of all, Donna Brazile has a book written by a journalist I trained, Danelle Morton, that will explain to you very troubling stuff about her hubris and the humiliation of Donna Brazile and her staff at the Democratic National Committee. And it's really a troubling story about not listening to advice. You know, in political campaigns, as David reminded me the other day, you're supposed to stick to your plan. But when you discover that your plan is the Maginot Line and the tanks are going around the edges, it's kind of time to reevaluate. It isn't just white working class people who got Trump that victory. I live in Rochester, New York, where my wife runs the Community Foundation. I have people I would describe as, they're not friends, but they're in my social circle, who are billionaires. And I know very wealthy people, not the billionaires per se, but very wealthy people, highly educated people, people with two doctorates in one case, who think that Donald Trump is what the country needs. And so it's not just white working class people who, by the way, keep in mind, this is one of the points in my book that Donald ran on. In 2012, the bottom 90% of Americans had smaller incomes than in 1967, the year I finished high school. Smaller incomes in 2012 than in 1967. These people, I've been their champion. They have real grievances. They have had their pockets picked. They've been lied to. They've had their pensions taken away. They've had their health care redone. They've had higher education put out of reach for many of them. And they have real grievances, and they were not being listened to. And to the extent that Hillary Clinton was listening to them, having sat and talked with people dressed not like this in blue-collar bars, basically she came across as blah, 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 blah. And by the way, blah, blah, blah. She didn't connect with people. There also are some structural issues. For 40 years, the Democrats have not been paying attention to their knitting. The Republicans, who are a minority, got laws passed that take away the franchise, that make it more difficult for people to register to vote, that allow you to kick people off. And in Michigan, they have this law where if the two poll watchers, the Republican and the Democrat, add up the votes, and one says, oh, 400 people voted today, and the other one says, no, it was 399. What would you think is the logical response? You're going to check and recount? No, you throw out all 800 votes. All right, last question was way back here.
So all this dirt or bad information or news or whatever you want to call it has been there and has never been put out there till after he was nominated. So why did the news not project all that information out there?
The question is about why wasn't stuff out there about Trump, and the assertion built into the question that it wasn't put out till the campaign. First of all, I've been writing stories about Trump since 1988. I have a book called Temples of Chance on the casino industry. It has a lot of the dirt about him. Wayne Barrett, to whom my book is dedicated, did the first Trump biography. He's the one who dug up the story of the helicopter pilot and the strange handling of the case. This stuff's been out there. It's been out there for decades. So the question is, how did it happen during the campaign that Donald wasn't the subject of what we call in the news business a scrub? And that means you go back to the life of this person to day one. That's how we know about Whitewater. That's how we know that Bill Clinton's underwear were donated to Goodwill, used underwear, $2 a pair. It's why we know the names of Barack Obama's playmates in kindergarten in Indonesia and the boys he smoked dope with in Honolulu. Donald Trump wasn't scrubbed. from the day of Donald Trump's announcement on June 16th of 2015 till Election Day in November of the next year, the New York Times had exactly four stories that had Trump and mafia. They were all passing references. Two of them were on the editorial page, and a typical example, one of those said, and then there's questions about Trump and the mafia. Questions? Questions? It's a man who built Trump Tower with mob concrete. A man who had the Teamsters head, Cody, on his payroll, and this very curious case of a woman who lived in the building and had no visible means of support and said basically she depended on the kindness of strangers. I mean, there's abundant evidence of this. Why didn't it get covered? Because I think everybody was so fascinated by the campaign. You know, we all rubberneck. Everybody, come on, be honest. There's an accident over here on the 95. We all slow down to see what happened. Donald Trump is that accident with dancing girls and a marching band and fireworks. And everybody was so dazzled by this that we didn't get the coverage. And I called my former editors at the New York Times. I called editors I know at the Washington Post, at Politico, where I did get a piece published. Donald threatened to sue me over, but he never has and never will. I called people I know all over the place. Foreign news organizations, some of them sent reporters to my house in Rochester, New York, eventually a dozen camera crews. None of the Americans. I got one call from the LA New York Times asking if there was a particular land use document. And I said, I don't think I have it, and it wasn't in my index. I may or may not have it. I got so many, and I'm not a perfect indexer. But it was all in the public record. It was right there to be written about. Everything I told you about Joe Wechselbaum, it's in the public record. And it was a complete failure on the part of news organizations. I know that at the New York Times, there's an awful lot of gnashing of teeth about it and an awful lot of condemning me for publicly talking about it. You know, I don't work there anymore, so I'm not obligated to be, you know, internal only in my gripes. So I want to thank you for coming. I hope that I have not left you feeling down. I want you to be optimistic. You know, I'm the father of eight kids. You can't have eight kids and not be an optimist. We can fix our country. We can have a better America. It only requires one thing. We need to recognize that the purpose of this country is to ennoble the human spirit to see what people can achieve, and to recognize that we control our destiny. So we have to get out and do the work of being citizens, and right now that means get people registered to vote, and come November, get them to the polls. Thank you. Mm-hmm.